Welcome back to session number 6 on the class, The Gospel of Mark. This session is titled Mission Expansion. Now, in the previous session, we saw a whole sequence of events that really characterized Jesus's ministry. It began with 4 specific events of healing, and then followed by 5 sequential conflicts with the Jewish religious leaders, culminating in the Jewish religious leaders' desire to destroy Jesus after he healed somebody on the Sabbath. In this session, we're going to look at how Jesus's ministry expands as he will call the 12 apostles and then be working through them to broaden his reach and the message of the kingdom. So we're going to start this session in Mark chapter 3 in verse 7. It says, "And Jesus withdrew to the lake." This is the Sea of Galilee, with his disciples, and a large crowd from Galilee followed him. And people from Judea and from Jerusalem and from Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon came to him when they heard about everything he was doing. And he told the disciples to prepare a small boat for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crush him. For he had healed many people, so all those who had afflictions were pressing toward him in order to touch him. So Jesus withdraws to the Sea of Galilee, which is really just a large lake. And so he's on the lake, he's going to the lake, and people are there from everywhere, and they're pressing in to touch him to receive healing, those who are afflicted with physical or spiritual maladies. And so Jesus asks for a boat, and the disciples get him a boat, and then he pushes off from the shore and begins to teach them. Now, there's a list of people here from all these different areas. What's mentioned here is there's people from the Galilee area, Judea, Idumea, Jerusalem, beyond the Jordan, from Tyre and Sidon. If we look at what this list represents, we'll see, okay, well, the Galilee area is right here around the Lake of Gennesaret or the Sea of Galilee. And then we're listed, well, down here is Judea. And in Judea here is Jerusalem, which is the capital, the religious center of the people of Israel. And then down below from there is Idumea. And then over here on the other side of the Jordan, this is beyond the Jordan area. And then up here in Phoenicia, we have Tyre and Sidon. And so we have basically the top from the north all the way to the south. And in between, all of these people are coming to see Jesus. And this kind of, I think, the crowds following Jesus, this sort of shows the way that Jesus's reputation was spreading and that people were coming. And the list of geographical places really does highlight the broad geographic representation of the need that people had. People from Galilee, which is where Jesus was currently ministering, as I mentioned, Judea and Jerusalem, which was the political and sort of like religious center of Judaism. Idumea, which is south, where they were viewed kind of as outsiders. And beyond the Jordan, which is the region of probably Perea and other regions along the Jordan River, which was a mixed Gentile population, where the 10 Gentile cities of the Decapolis were. And Tyre and Sidon, which were northern coastal cities of Phoenicia, they were definitely pagan Gentile territory. But all of these people from all of these nations and places were coming because they wanted to hear Jesus and because they had needs that they needed healing. Also, this shows the signs of Jesus's growing fame and influence, where people had heard what he was doing through his teachings, his healings, his miracles, and they were willing to travel long distances to see him. And this shows the impact and the urgency of Jesus's ministry. He wasn't just this little local preacher up in the backwash of Galilee area. His name was being known throughout the entire region of this part of the Mediterranean. This also, I think, foreshadows the broad global reach of the good news. That even though it started out in a small little area around Galilee, it's already growing and it's expanding rapidly. This also shows the tension that is with the religious authorities, because just a few verses earlier, we saw about how the Pharisees and the Herodians, they wanted to plot how to kill Jesus. And immediately afterward, though, we see here that everybody wants to see Jesus. The religious authorities don't want him, but everybody else does. What a stark contrast. While the Jewish religious elites, they want to get rid of him, the general masses of people, both Israelite and non-Israelite, are drawn to him, and they want to see what he has to say, and they want to receive what he has to offer. Lastly, this list really does exemplify cultural and ethnic diversity, where we have Samaritans, Jews, probably descendants of the Edomites from down in Idumea, the Gentiles and other groups from outside of Israel, like up in the Phoenicia area. And each had different cultural norms, languages, and expectations of what a Messiah would be. And this diversity really underlines how Jesus appealed to this broad spectrum of human need, because everybody, no matter where you live, if you are afflicted, if you're sick, if you're tormented, everybody wants to be free from that. Everybody wants to be healed from that. And when you hear about Jesus, who's going around, he's casting out demons, he's healing people, people with deformities, people with paralysis, people with skin diseases, people wanted what he was doing and what he had to offer, to where he showed the power of the kingdom for all who wanted it. It's not just about one tribe or one tradition or one nation. This serves as a representative of the open invitation of God's kingdom for all who want to enter. Now, as we saw at the end here, all those who had afflictions were pressing toward him in order to touch him. And then it says in verse 11, and when the unclean spirits saw him, so people were coming to get healed. Among those people were people who had afflictions with evil spirits. When these unclean or evil spirits saw Jesus, they fell down before him and they cried out. And again, identifying him, you are the Son of God. And he sternly warned them not to make him known. In the previous session, we talked about this motif in Mark's gospel, where Jesus strives to quench the spread of his identity, to subdue people from announcing him. Here he's telling the evil spirits of these people that, and they just blatantly kind of call out who he is. He tells them not to make him known. They are not to identify him as the Son of God, as the Messiah. This is what is known as the messianic secret in the Gospel of Mark. And there are a number of times when this occurs. There's no less than 8 occurrences where Jesus makes explicit mention for people or spirits to not announce or declare his identity. Now, we went through a couple reasons why that could be in the last session. It could be to prevent misunderstanding, where perhaps people expected a different type of Messiah, and Jesus didn't want to announce that he was the Messiah, so people would then sort of like have a misaligned expectation. Jesus wanted to redefine what kind of a Messiah he was. Could be because of timing, that Jesus did not want his identity to be revealed too early. He wanted to have it be revealed after he had suffered, died, and was raised, as he makes mention of that in Mark chapter 9. Or to produce what is called narrative tension. This is where, as a reader, you're reading something that is in narrative, and you know information that the people or characters in the story don't. And so perhaps Mark is building this dramatic suspense through narrative tension, where the readers know who Jesus is because the spirits are announcing it, but the characters, his disciples, the people around him, they're struggling to really grasp, who is this Jesus of Nazareth, this rabbi who's doing all these miracles and healing people and casting out demons? So it could be one or a combination of those reasons, or perhaps something else. But it definitely is noticeable as we will be going through Mark's gospel that Jesus does this time and time again. It's a recurring motif. All right, moving on to chapter 3, verse 13. In the next segment, Jesus went up on the mountain and he called to himself those whom he wanted, and they came to him. So Jesus calls certain people up with him on the mountain the ones that he wanted. And it says, and he appointed 12, whom he named apostles, so that they would be with him and so that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out demons. And he appointed the 12, and these are the 12. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder, and Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot. And finally, Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. So Jesus takes a number of people up on the mountain, and he calls out 12 individuals that he names apostles. These 12 apostles are very special individuals to Jesus in his ministry. And he appoints them, and he gives 3 specific reasons for naming these individuals as apostles. He says that they are to be with him, they are to be sent out to preach, and they are to have authority to cast out demons. Now, what's the significance of these 3 purposes? Let's look at what the meaning of the 12 can consist of. Now, calling 12 apostles really is a clear echo to the history of Israel with the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob. 12 individuals founded the nation of Israel. Here Jesus is calling and appointing 12 individuals. He's forming a new community. Secondly, discipleship and relationship. When Jesus says that he names these individuals as apostles, he specifically says that it is so that they will be with him. That Jesus wasn't just naming them apostles and then telling them to be gone and do your thing. No, the first reason that is given is so that these people would have a special relationship with Jesus. And I think this is not just for them. This is a model of being a disciple and follower of Jesus, is to be with Jesus. Discipleship and relationship go hand in hand. One cannot be a disciple if they do not have a relationship with Jesus. And so Jesus's first apostles, his closest followers, were to be with him and to have that close relationship. Next, he says that he did it so that they could go out and preach the message of the kingdom. They could preach the good news. So they have a mission, and they're also given authority to cast out demons. So the reason why Jesus named them apostles, which kind of means people who are sent, or who are sort of like messengers, those who carry and bring a message, they are also given authority, like Jesus, over the kingdom of Satan, to command evil spirits and to drive them out and to free people from bondage. Next, the list of 12 kind of shows the inclusivity and imperfection of Jesus's followers. All of these individuals that Jesus names, they don't all come from like kind of like one stock around Capernaum. They come from various different backgrounds, particularly if we're talking about, for example, Simon, who was the zealot particularly, he was a specific nationalist and potentially had a background in treasonous activities and trying to undermine the government of Rome. And so he had a background unlike the fishermen of Peter and Andrew and James and John, who were uneducated individuals who had a simple occupation. Moving on to, like, for example, Matthew, who is named Levi. When we saw in the last session where Jesus calls Levi the son of Alphaeus, that is Matthew. He's a tax collector. He has training to count coin and to sit at the booth and to work for Rome. He's basically a Roman collaborator, and not to mention a number of others in the group that were different, and especially the last person mentioned, Judas Iscariot. Mark specifically narrates, kind of like proleptically or like foreshadowing, what is to come by saying he's the one who betrayed Jesus. Spoiler alert, he basically kind of like includes that little piece of information where, as the reader, as we're going along, we have no idea what's coming ahead. But Mark narrates this little tidbit to show that one of the 12 is actually a betrayer. So I think this list has a lot of diversity in it and shows the imperfection of the people that Jesus chose to be his closest followers. Right, next segment in chapter 3, verse 19, the latter part of verse 19 picks up, and he came home. Now this home is Capernaum. Jesus lived in Capernaum. It was where he had his kind of like his home base. Could say it was like his headquarters for his ministry outreach. So he comes back to Capernaum, and it says in verse 20, and the crowd came together again to such an extent that they were not able to even eat, or they were not even able to eat. And when his family heard this, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he's out of his mind. So Jesus' popularity and growing recognition is interfering here with daily life. Due to Jesus' increasing renown, the religious leaders in Jerusalem, well, they had sent delegates to undercut his ministry here. But before that, Jesus is with his family, and so many people are coming together that he can't even eat. Him and his disciples, they're in their home, and so many people are trying to access him, they can't even have their meal. And when his family heard this, I think they had enough. We don't understand kind of like the background of like, was this the first time his family had gotten concerned? Or was this kind of like the last straw that broke the camel's back? Nevertheless, his family decides it's time to act. So we saw how the religious leaders were trying to interfere with Jesus and then ultimately wanting to destroy Jesus. And that and the kind of like antagonism that he got from them. And now he's finding it with his own family. His own family wants to come and interfere with his ministry. And it uses the text here, Mark uses a very strong word. They want to come and seize him. They want him to stop this business. Jesus, this is crazy. Look at all these people. Send them away. They think he's out of his mind. His family doesn't understand. The religious leaders don't understand and certainly don't approve. So the religious leaders get sent from Jerusalem. So Jesus is causing such a ruckus, you might say, or he's becoming so well known and so many people are coming that it reaches the ears of the religious leaders in the capital. So up in Jerusalem, in the hills of Judea, people are sent to come down into the Galilee area. And when they come, they confront Jesus. And what they say here, they say, he has Beelzebul. And by the power of the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons. This tactic of the Pharisees, the experts in the law here, from Jerusalem as delegates representing the Judaism of Israel, they come to undercut his ministry, not by denying the miracles, because I think they could not say that the miracles didn't happen when everybody is witnessing them. So they change their strategy, and they now try to spin a story that explains what Jesus is doing is actually not from God. It's actually the evil spirit Beelzebul. That is the person who Jesus is working with, whereby he's able to do these things. And so they say that Jesus is possessed by a demon himself, and not just any demon, Beelzebul. This is a kind of an alias for Satan. So they're saying it's by the power of the ruler of the demons. They're saying Jesus is in cahoots with the king of the evil realm. The king of the evil spirits is actually working in Jesus. That's what you see and hear, folks. Well, how does Jesus respond to this? To address his opponent's accusation, Jesus does two things. He offers a refutation for their accusation, and then he offers an explanation. He doesn't just simply say, "You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about." He doesn't fire back like that. But he does show them why they're wrong. However, he doesn't resort to any sort of like vitriol or anger, but he simply dismantles their faulty proposition by showing the incongruity in it. And here's how the refutation goes. In verse 23, he says, "And he called them over to himself and began speaking to them in parables." So Jesus is like, come here. Let me share something with you. And then he speaks to them in parables. Well, the parable is, he says, how is the adversary able to cast out the adversary? It's really kind of a rhetorical question rather than a parable. If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom is not able to stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if the adversary has risen up against himself and is divided, he is not able to stand, but his end has come. So this rhetorical question that Jesus raises, how is the adversary able to cast out the adversary? It really isn't meant to raise suspicions on, what's the mechanism by which this happened? It's really more geared toward, why would this happen? Tell me, why would the adversary do this? What benefit would Satan derive by driving out a demon from a person? That is the goal of Satan's empire, isn't it? To oppress and enslave and afflict people with his power. Therefore, if Jesus undermines the advancement of Satan's kingdom by Satan himself, well then, how does that actually promote it? It would be self-defeating, wouldn't it? If he were working in concert with Satan to then free people from the influence of demons, demonic influence in people's lives is what Satan wants. So why would Satan want to undo that? Jesus is sort of countering the logic here by saying, it doesn't work, folks. I can't be doing what Satan doesn't want by Satan's power. I think William Hendrickson kind of sums this up pretty accurately when he says, first, and this is in response to the illogicality of the experts in the law and the Pharisees and their accusation. First, he, which is Satan here, Beelzebul, or the adversary, he would be sending out his envoys, which are the demons, to work havoc in the hearts and lives of men, destroying them, body and soul, often little by little. Afterward, as it were in base ingratitude and suicidal folly, he would be supplying the very power needed for the shameful defeat and expulsion of his own obedient servants. No kingdom thus divided against itself can maintain itself. Jesus is showing the religious leaders that the strangeness of their accusation and sort of like how contradictory it is that if he were working with Satan, he's actually undoing the realm and dominion of Satan in people's lives. Why would he do that? And so then he refutes the claim, and then next he goes to explain, I'll tell you how it happens. So he now does an actual little mini parable in verse 27. On the contrary, no one can enter the house of the strong man and plunder his property unless he first ties up the strong man, and then he can plunder his house. So after refuting the Pharisees and the religious leaders' accusation with this tact and collectedness, he doesn't even seem like he even maybe raises his voice at all. He just asks them a real simple question that sort of shows the self-defeating logic that they tried to offer. But he's in the face of intense opposition here because he's being charged through the accusation of a capital crime. If in fact he were in cahoots, or if he was in concert with Satan, then according to the old covenant the Mosaic covenant law, he should be killed. But he proceeds to answer their inquiry with this short parable that indirectly alludes to the fact that he actually has greater power than Satan. Through this brief parable, Jesus is identifying himself indirectly as the stronger man. So he says, no one can enter the house of a strong man and plunder his property unless he first ties up the strong man. Well, Jesus is going into the, quote, house of Satan, and he's kicking out demons. Satan is the strong man, and if he is going in and he's stealing the goods from Satan's house, which are the lives, the bodies and souls of people, he has to tie up the strong man. He has to bind Satan so that he can do it. He is the stronger man. If Jesus is casting out the servants of Satan and he's restoring people mentally, physically, and spiritually, then he's doing so because he has greater authority and power than Satan. Not because Satan is working with him. Through the power of the Holy Spirit and the authority that God has invested in Jesus, Jesus here is seen to be launching a campaign against Satan's realm and is depriving Satan of the influence in people's lives. And he's taking back territory by exhibiting the superior power of God's kingdom. Not just through the healings and the expelling or casting out of demons, but through also the expansion of Jesus's ministry through the spread of the good news. Through God's kingdom, he's launching an assault on Satan's kingdom, and he's shaking Satan's kingdom here to the very core. Satan's minions, the demons, when they see Jesus, they shriek, they fall on the ground, they yell out, "What do you want, Son of God?" Satan's kingdom is terrified. They know they're outmatched. And as we're reading this, we see Jesus demonstrating that superiority through the deliverance ministry where these spirits, these unclean and evil spirits, are cowering in fear in his presence. And so Jesus is bringing with him the power of the kingdom to disrupt and ultimately destroy God's enemy, Satan. Now, in response to this incident and conflict, Jesus then follows up with this warning. In verse 28, he says, "Truly I say to you, people will be forgiven all their sins and whatever blasphemies they speak. But whoever blasphemes the Holy Spirit will never be forgiven, but is guilty of an everlasting sin." And he was saying this because they were saying he has an unclean spirit. In a sobering follow-up here, Jesus warns that to claim his work is actually the work of Satan is to blaspheme the Holy Spirit, which Jesus says is unforgivable. This harsh rebuke really seems to be aimed at presenting the seriousness of the accusation of the Jewish religious leaders and the gravity of the consequences that they would face. Jesus is essentially pronouncing judgment upon them. In order to pronounce judgment, that means he has to have a higher authority than they. Well, moving away from this scene, Mark then transitions back to a family context. Now, verse 31, and his mother and his brothers arrived. So they heard about this somehow, and they came to where this was happening. And so they now arrive, and they're standing outside, and they sent word to him, calling for him, and the crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Look, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you." And answering them, he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking around at those who were sitting in a circle around him, which would include his 12 apostles, other disciples, and the Jewish religious leaders, he said, "Look, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." This incident here is kind of picking back up from verse 21, where Jesus' family was coming and they wanted to seize him. And now this is sort of painting Jesus' family as antagonists against him. And he decides to show the distinction between the familial, the biological, genealogical ties to redefining what true family is. He shows that true family are those who care more about the work of God that he has called them to than the socio-biological concerns of their community and their family. Well, in the ancient culture, the family unit was the basis of all social and civil life. Families would often live near each other, if not together, in the same kind of facility, compound, or large house. And they typically would share everything in common. The Israelite culture highly valued family relationships. It was the very basic fabric of their community and society. Loyalty to one's family was paramount to a proper honoring of God and living out the covenant blessings that God had promised. A person, an Israelite, was to see their identity as being part of their family and thus part of the greater community. Therefore, for Jesus to challenge this conception of family, he's basically undermining the very foundation of the Israelite way of life. His statement about who is my mother and my brother, in a way, is a very big slap in the face. I'm sure his mothers and his brothers were probably appalled to hear him say this. But Jesus wasn't coming to say the things that people wanted to hear. He was coming to say the things that they needed to hear. And here's where Jesus sort of draws the line. He says, my true family are those who think and live the way I do, serving the will of my Father. Those are my siblings. Those are my brother, sister, and mother. Now, Jesus isn't saying that family is not important. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying, though, is that there's new family ties that are more important. There is a superiority at work here, and they can be mutually exclusive if necessary, but don't have to be, where doing the will of God is what establishes family relationships. And if your family is not serving God and doing the will of God, then they're not your family. This is about as radical a position that Jesus could take as that's possible. The shock factor for this in their time and in their culture is just unreal. We cannot fathom the impact that this sort of a statement would have in the hearts of his family and those around him. Because solidarity with one's biological family was essentially on the same level as Torah observance, being an Israelite. And to say that your family wasn't your family, but the people here who are doing the will of your Father, they are your family. This would have rattled anybody who heard it. But it's this radical call of Jesus, of which we saw when he called his first disciples, because his first disciples left their current situation in life and family to go and follow Jesus. It's this type of radical commitment that Jesus is asking of those who are his disciples and followers. And so I think N.T. Wright puts it well, and we'll close with this. The gospel, the good news, and allegiance to Jesus produce a division, often an unexpected and unwelcome one. In every group or society where they make their way, Mark's call to his readers then and now is to stick with Jesus, whatever the cost. In the next session, we're going to see how Mark strategically uses some of Jesus's teachings with parables to help people better understand the kingdom of God.